Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002, and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Europe, the EU and the Bruges Group. We talked to Robert Olds. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. Anyway, first of all, Robert Olds from the Bruges Group. Robert joins me on the line. Hi, Robert, and welcome to Dialect.
Thank you.
Tell us, what is the Bruges Group, Robert, and how did it start?
Yeah, the Bruges Group is a think tank, and we produce publications, do research, hold meetings. And basically, we spearhead the intellectual fight against the European Union, and really what we would like to see is a completely different setup in Europe, where Europe is a collection of independent, self-governing, democratic nation-states, rather than belonging to the monolithic organisation which the European Union is, in our opinion. And we were founded after a speech by Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher made her speech in September 1988 to the College of Europe in Bruges, where she set out an alternative vision, one different to the current direction of the European Union, where there's ever closer union and further centralisation, and set out a different vision, and we were then created to turn that vision into a reality. So that's one thing that we've been campaigning on through our research and our work over 25 years.
Well, the trouble is, of course, that actually the EU is a kind of a federation, with all the independent states have got quite a good degree of independence. Germany, France, Britain, etc. have got their own parliaments and got their own laws, surely.
They have their own parliaments, but one of the main things that they spend their time doing is rubber stamping European Union rules. More than half our new laws come from the European Union. A 2010 report by the House of Commons found that it's usually around 50%, sometimes it could be 48%, as much as 53% of our new laws come from the European Union. The German Parliament, the Bundestag, they estimated that actually 84% of laws going through the Bundestag are ones coming down from the European Union, where they're told what to do. Of course, the situation in Germany is slightly different to Britain. They have a higher percentage going through their parliament because they devolve more down to their local level, their Länder, places like Bavaria or Württemberg and various places within Germany. So basically, the main job of the German parliament is to rubber stamp EU laws, which they have no say in making, and of course have to obey, or they would be fined by the European Court of Justice, because European Union law takes precedence over national law. So what is happening is that countries effectively are run by the institutions of the European Union.
Well, those institutions, surely there's a fair amount of democracy involved in all that, because we elect all these MEPs, don't we?
The MEPs can't initiate legislation. In the Parliament, usually you have your MPs who propose the laws. In the European system, they cannot actually do that. In the European Parliament, MPs do not propose legislation. The legislation is proposed by the European Commission, which is unelected. And the European Parliament has very little say in actually the laws being made.
Well, surely the MEPs make the final decision as to whether it's going to come into law. Even if it is a new law is made by an unelected body, it's finally down to the MEPs who we elect to decide whether or not it goes into law across Europe or not.
No, that's not quite correct. Often the way the debates work in the European Parliament is that there would be, the laws are being voted on, there would be a show of hands, and often there could be as many as 3,000 laws that have to pass through the EU's legislatures because there's several legislatures within the European Union, not just the European Parliament. I'll come to that later. And there's not often adequate debate. MPs can only speak for 90 seconds in when there's a plenary session, when there are debates on European Union law. And often there's just a show of hands and it just goes through and it's rubber stamped. There's not really adequate debate. Sometimes a European committee, a committee of the European Parliament, can actually have influence, but that's a very small, select number of MEPs. The European Parliament as a whole doesn't really have much of an effective say because they only meet several times a month and they have to get through a total of 3,000 laws a year. It can be as high as that. And the burden is absolutely overwhelming and there's never, ever proper scrutiny. The main aspect, the main parliament within the European system, in terms of it being a legislature, isn't actually the European Parliament. It's actually the Council of Ministers. In the Council of Ministers, that's where a lot of the key decisions are made when they're voting on these proposals from the unelected European Commission. But the Council of Ministers, there's never actually any minutes taken. We do not actually know what was said in the discussions. They are done in private. Imagine we ask an MP what they said about a particular issue in Parliament. And they said, well, we can't tell you. There's no minutes. It's all private.
Amazing. I mean, it sounds like...
If your MEP wouldn't tell you what they said in Parliament. Of course, the minutes of what they say in our Parliament, in the House of Commons, just like any other Parliament around the world, it's explained, people speak there, and it's all recorded, and the public are made known of what is being said. In the Council of Ministers, when they vote on European Union rules, it's done in secrecy. We know how each country votes, but we don't know what was said, what the discussions involved. That is appalling. There's really not enough scrutiny over the European system, partly because the European Parliament is inadequate, and also because the Council of Ministers is, of course, meets in secret.
Yes, but you see, our cabinet also meets in secret. You can't, I'm afraid, go along and find out from a Secretary of State what did you say and what was discussed and what was minuted in the cabinet discussions at Downing Street yesterday.
The cabinet does not make laws. They will come to proposals and they will have private discussions. But the Council of Ministers is a legislature. It is, in a sense, one of the EU's parliaments. It's not called a parliament, but they vote on the laws. The cabinet in Britain does not vote on the laws. They will have private discussions, just like we can't actually know what is being said in the European Commission and in the European Commission working groups when they're developing legislative proposals which affect every single member of the European Union. That's all 500 million of us, from Ireland to Estonia or Portugal to
Finland.
Amazing.
It's absolutely amazing. 500 million people is a lot of people. And we would think that more of those 500 million people would understand how this all works or doesn't work. So we've got three main bodies, the Commission, the Parliament and the Council of Ministers. You've just been talking about the Council of Ministers. Who makes that up, that Council of Ministers? Who sits in those meetings?
Well, the whole process behind the Council of Ministers, because it's, on the face of it, ultimately the Council of Ministers are the relevant ministers from each member state. And if they're discussing something to do with, say, for instance, agriculture, then the British or any other member state's agriculture minister will then be at the Council of Ministers for that meeting and will vote according to what they want to do on the issue before them, which would be agriculture. When it's a finance issue, then it would be finance ministers and they would meet as ECOFIN and so forth. Behind that, there's a whole process where the laws are actually developed and actually agreed before the Council of Ministers actually get to vote through a meeting of, again, which is in secret, meeting of effectively civil servants known as co-repper and co-repper 2, where they will be developing the laws, voting on them, seeing if they can get them passed, and then by the time it comes to the Council of Ministers, it's already a done deal. So even though they have a vote, it's already pretty much decided what each country would be voting and whether or not it will be approved, and usually it does come into force. and is usually approved because it's already been decided at previous stages, which we are not party to what is being discussed. And of course, it's not actually people we've elected who are leading the discussion.
No, they are usually, I mean, they're MPs, but they're people who the MPs have then put into, you know, into the cabinet or whatever, which is actually one step removed, really, from the ordinary people, isn't it?
Well, the Council of Ministers, the ministers have been elected through a country's democratic process, but the people who meet COREPA 2 have not been elected, and they're the ones which are really forming the laws.
Amazing. What about
for the Council of Ministers?
What about the Commission then? Well, let's just try and break this down, because I don't think much of the mainstream press, the TV, the radio, the newspapers, don't really do this for us. What is the Commission? Because they are the guys in the driving seats, aren't they?
Absolutely, yes. The Commission is effectively the government of the European Union, except they haven't been elected. What happens is that the leaders of the nation states which make up the European Union will agree between them who would be the president of the European Commission. Countries will then have the right to nominate someone to fulfil a task within the European Union to become what's known as a commissioner. However, it's the president of the European Commission who decides what person gets what job. So Britain, for instance, it put forward someone called Lord Hill to be its commissioner. The job he got in the end was being in charge of issues to do with the single market and, of course, financial services within the European Union. But that decision was taken by the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, and gave him that task before the role was Britain's commission was Baroness Catherine Ashton, of course, someone who was actually never elected to anything. She was given her job as a high representative. But it's the situation is one where the commissioner is really put in place by the president of the European Commission, and he can then, in a sense, control what legislation would flow out of that commissioner's department, because, of course, he would know that the person that he's giving the job to would be someone who would produce rules which he would want to see enacted and put in place. So a lot of the power within the European Commission, it not only rests with people who are unelected, but often it can rest with just one particular person, the president of the European Commission themselves, who have a great deal of influence over what will happen. So it's a very centralised system, and it's centralised on people who are unelected, and in often one unelected person, the president of the commission.
Amazing. Really, it's incredible that there's such a massive system with, like you're saying, with 500 million people, is so undemocratic. Well, what about the Jean-Claude Juncker, who's the new president of the commission? He's often talked about, at least in political circles, as the president of Europe, yet no one's elected him. Tell us a bit about this guy. Who is he?
Well, he is a former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, which is a very, very small country. So even when he was elected...
Look, it's also a tax haven.
...by the Luxembourgers, it was a very small electorate.
But it's also a tax haven, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. And Jean-Claude Juncker was very much involved as a Prime Minister of Luxembourg in really arranging for companies who would base themselves in Luxembourg to have very low rates of tax. The corporation tax within Luxembourg is actually not that low, but what often happens, and this happens in the UK, but it happens more so within Luxembourg, is that the Luxembourg inland revenue would, of course, give very preferential deals to companies that would base themselves in Luxembourg, where they really wouldn't have to pay much corporation tax. And that's why many countries such as Starbucks, for instance, arrange their taxes according to Luxembourg. So the profits end up going to Luxembourg where they're not taxed. And then, of course, means that the nation state's treasury can't get hold of the company's money in terms of corporation tax, because, of course, it goes to Luxembourg, where there would often be a sweetheart deal put in place for a company just to have an office there, which they would then claim that is his company's head office, whatever that was, certainly the case with Starbucks. Well, it happens with other companies. It's not illegal, but it certainly seems rather immoral to me.
Well, it is. Listen, it is absolutely right. I mean, this is certainly an organisation which is not being run by or in the interests of ordinary people across Europe. So who is actually in charge here? I mean, who is pulling the strings of Jean-Claude Juncker and the Commission? Who are the people actually writing the new laws that are coming in the first place? Who's actually doing this?
Well, the European Union is very open to lobbying. It's not open to democratic input through the ballot box because, of course, the mechanisms for the public to get involved in the decision-making, even democratically elected politicians, to get involved in the EU's decision-making is actually very small. But it is very open to lobbying. Businesses will spend a lot of money trying to influence opinion within the European Union. The European Union itself actually goes out and consults with businesses directly. It goes out and consults with what it calls civil society groups, which is any organisation that has influence. The European Union will listen to them, but it's not listening to ordinary people, it's listening to organisations that have money, be they very well-funded campaign groups or, of course, big business. And, of course, they then influence the European Commission directly in its working groups, where it's discussing what laws should come forward, and then finally produces them. And it's something which is totally not transparent. It is very difficult to actually see what is going on, who is influencing the European Union and the European Commission in particular via these working groups. We just do not know exactly, but what we can be sure of is that it's producing thousands of laws each year, many of which affect businesses either positively or negatively, but of course it's usually big businesses that are driving the agenda within the European Union.
Okay, well, what about the European Roundtable of Industrialists? Because I know that this is an organisation which makes me think that actually there's not a lot of difference between the United States of America and the EU countries nowadays, because many of these big companies that sit around this European Roundtable of Industrialists table are actually writing some of these new laws that are then simply the European Commission just simply changes the logo on the top of the PDF file and has a new kind of stamp on it, but it's actually written by these big corporations, which of course are multinational nowadays. The big companies that are powerful in Europe are also usually big in the United States too. So is there really very much difference between the EU and the United States?
The system in America is different. There is a problem with lobbying. We know this. There's a problem with the way funds are distributed within the United States. But, of course, ultimately, America is still more democratic than the institutions of the European Union. Ultimately, in the United States, there's still politicians who are ultimately responsible for proposing the laws, be that the president or would be members of Congress, senators or congressmen, either in the Senate or the House of Representatives. And ultimately, the buck should stop with them. Of course, things in America, largely because of the political culture, the influence of big business, means that it doesn't necessarily work out to be as democratic as what the founders of the American Constitution
and also
would hope. But in the European Union, it is very much people behind the doors, people who aren't even accountable at the ballot box, that are driving the decision. So in the situation in the EU is indeed much worse.
What about the euro? Because I guess many people think it's quite good that we're not necessarily in the eurozone now, since so many of the European Central Bank euro countries are having quite a bad time. I mean, like Italy, Portugal, Spain and Greece, all of those countries are looking at themselves now and wondering, well, was it a good idea, the euro?
The euro has been an absolute disaster. That's one of the things that the Bruges Group was warning about going back to the early 1990s when this was first discussed as part of the Maastricht Treaty, which was the legal base for a lot of the single currency, which later became known as the euro, and all the problems which have flowed since then. But the euro is a prime example of the one-size-fits-none European Union policies that have created untold damage across large parts of Europe. We see France in recession, Italy is in deep recession, mass unemployment in Spain and Greece. There's been economic problems within the UK, but they pale in comparison to what has been happening within the Eurozone because of the wrong-headed policies designed to underpin the single currency, and of course the way that they put the international financial system above that of ordinary people. Countries within the Eurozone, many of them, such as Greece for instance, needed to purge the debt. They needed to default on the debt, but the European Union kept them locked into a system where they were having to pay increasingly high amounts of interest on the debt that shouldn't have been lent in the first place, when of course they should have defaulted. They should have been allowed to have their own currency, run their economies as they see fit, have an injection of capital to stimulate economic growth. But what's been happening is they've had really severe austerity forced upon them, which in countries such as Greece created more than 25% unemployment. In Spain, it was more than 25%.
Amazing.
Unemployment went up to 27%. And of course, in youth unemployment was above 50%. In some parts of Spain, it was above 60%. Young people have literally no future within those countries because the European Union, the European Central Bank, as well as the IMF, enforced deflationary policies upon them, which have now ruined their economies, massive unemployment, next to no economic growth, all in the interest of protecting the euro and making sure that the flow of debt continued to flow to the financial institutions that have lent them the money in the first place, which was incredibly reckless.
Yeah, Robert, also what worries me is when you've got this kind of mass austerity, which appears to be being imposed by the Eurozone on these big parts of Europe. When if you look back to the 1920s and 30s in pre-Nazi Germany, it was actually a bit of a breeding ground for fascism, wasn't it?
Exactly. When you have such severe economic problems, then people will ultimately go off to the extremes. And when there's been economic harm put on people, then there would be a danger that people will go and have to exercise their voice through extremist parties. That is happening in Germany. That happened in Germany. It's happening now in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, France. There's a great deal of economic problems. They are in recession. People have very little prospect there. That's why many French people are actually fleeing France and coming to the UK to live and work, because there's such economic problems. And in that situation, when they vote at the ballot box, it doesn't make any difference because the key decisions are not made by people that they've elected in their national democracies, then of course ultimately people will turn to the extremes.
But what can we do? Because that's what people like you at the Bruges Group are supposed to be making some kind of alternative, creating an alternative and making it happen right from your first origins with Margaret Thatcher. Because for many people, looking back on those days, it was when she started to assert her independence, the sovereignty of Britain, against the Maastricht Treaty, and against the idea of going into the exchange rate mechanism as it was then, that many people believe that as soon as she started to do that, that was the way she was elbowed out. But what can we do now?
You're absolutely right. Margaret Thatcher was removed from power primarily over the issue of the European Union, the European Economic Community as it was then. But what Britain can do is that Britain can leave the European Union. There are a number of off-the-shelf alternatives that Britain can join. There's the European Free Trade Association, which Britain originally led in establishing in 1960. That's still going. They're doing very well. They have very low unemployment. They have higher standards of living than other countries in Europe. Britain left the European Union. We could rejoin the European Free Trade Association. I think we'll still get full access to the single market, probably via the what's known as the European Economic Area. Trade would continue, but we wouldn't be so burdened by the EU, and we would be a democracy again and largely self-governing. That's what we should aspire to, and that would actually be very refreshing. I think it actually Europe would benefit if Britain left the European Union, because then, of course, other countries can see that Britain has done hopefully well outside of the EU, and they will want to leave as well. And the whole sorry episode of the European Union damaging economies within Europe, damaging people's livelihoods, damaging their prospects, that will be over. Britain leaves, other countries will probably want to leave as well, because of course life is better outside the EU.
Well, I think many Norwegians would say the same, because they have big trade relations obviously with the rest of Europe, but they're not actually in the European Union.
Exactly, yes, and they have a higher standard of living, they have a functioning democracy, they have higher GDP per capita, and that's even when the oil and the fish, that a large part of the Norwegian economy is taken out. They have very high foreign direct investment. Switzerland as well is also outside the European Union, and yet they are a lot better off, and they still enjoy good trade with the EU, but of course they're not dictated to the same degree as Britain is being in the European Union. That means there's a loss of sovereignty, means that you're pretty much told what to do by the European Commission, whereas countries like Norway and Switzerland, they have more independence. That's a better situation. It's something that we can aspire to. And of course, in time, I think others will want to follow us.
But the trouble is, of course, Robert, you at the Bruges Group are on a hiding to nothing, because the EU is far too powerful, it seems, to allow any kind of real expression of sentiment in the British political system, even with the United Kingdom Independence Party. Yes, they may get a few MPs in May's general election, but there's not enough, I'm afraid, to actually force an EU exit, is there?
Well, the people of this country can be quite stubborn. They don't like being told what to do by the European Union or any other foreign power, and they will assert their independence. And when the British people speak, the European Union will just have to take note. It doesn't matter whether they're listening or not. Britain is, of course, a major economy in the world, the sixth largest economy, probably the fifth as we're overtaking France. We have a seat on the United Nations. We have diplomatic clout around the world. Britain is an important country, and if Britain really, the British people want to make sure that their country is free and independent and self-governing, then no one can really stop us. Yes, there will be a lot of propaganda coming from the European Union. There will be money spent if there were to be a referendum in the UK to try and make people stay with the European Union. But we're just going to have to match that, and just going to have to fight against, and ultimately, if the British people do decide to come out of the European Union, then that will just have to be respected by the European Union itself.
But the fact of the matter is that it's not going to be the British people's chance to make that decision. It looks as if the Conservative Party, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats are all rather like being part of the EU. And if unless UKIP can get a majority, which doesn't sound very likely at the next general election, that there's no chance of an EU exit.
You are right that the three main parties, of course, I'm not sure whether we can class the Liberal Democrats as a main party anymore, but Conservatives and Labour do, the parties, the leadership itself, do actually still support continued membership of the European Union. However, there are people within the Labour Party who are deeply sceptical of the European Union and the whole project behind it. Of course, originally the Labour Party was the most Eurosceptic political party and were opposed to membership of the EU's forerunners, the European Economic Community, and it was the Conservative Party that was actually seen as the pro-EU party. Of course, there has been some change, but there still remain sceptics within Labour and within the Conservative Party as well.
But you see my point, Robert, you see my point. Actually, at the end of the day, it's all very well saying this, the British people will decide, but if the Lib Dems, Conservatives and Labour are all into staying with the European Union, it just simply isn't going to happen.
Well, they will have to be forced. The British public need, who are generally opposed to the European Union, according to the opinion polls, at the moment, as things stand, more people would vote to come out of the European Union than stay in. If the British public are really going to take action, then they won't be able to stop us. The party leaderships will have to listen. They will be made to listen if the British public unite and campaign vigorously. But it does mean that people who are sceptical about the European Union but generally apathetic and aren't getting involved in Eurosceptic groups and the campaign itself, that's a problem. They will need to get involved. So if people do want to have our self-determination back, then this really is a matter that we can force political parties to listen. But only if people get engaged, join a Eurosceptic group now, get involved with the campaign, deliver leaflets, tell your friends, spread the message about to other people, and then we will get there. Many things have happened when there's been opposition from the elites, and over time they've been forced to listen, if of course there's been a vigorous campaign from the bottom up.
Okay, so Robert, how do people find the Bruges Group or follow the work that you do?
Well, we're available, we are on the internet. Just type in Bruges Group, B-R-U-G-E-S, then group into your web browser, and of course we'll come up, and there's a way of getting involved. You can contact me via email or via the website, or of course can just call 0207 287 4414, and I'll be happy to speak to anyone that wants to get involved and wants to make sure that our country is a democracy again.
Could you just give us the phone number again, please, Robert?
Yes, 0207 287 4414.
Okay.
0207 287 4414.
Great. Three times. I hope you got it, folks. Robert Olds there, director of the Bruges Group. Thanks ever so much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined now by education campaigner Christine Townsend. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
Welcome to Dialect.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you here. Tell us a little bit about what got you into campaigning around education. Why not just sort of carry on doing a little bit of education yourself, teaching, that sort of thing?
Well, I left. I came back to live and work in Bristol, which is where I'm from, where I grew up, at the City Academy across the way. In 2003, so that was the first year that it became an academy, and it was the first school that became an academy. And since then, what's happened is the whole of the secondary sector has become academies or free schools, and about a third of our primary schools have also left local authority control.
Okay, so tell us, what is an academy school? Because for a lot of people this has happened. Maybe their youngsters are going along, the children are going along to a school, but they don't know what the difference is between the old system and the new system within academy.
Well, in the old system, the local authority was responsible for the quality of the education that happened, and they employed the people that worked in the schools, and they had overall responsibility for running the school. Now, with an academy or a free school, that overall responsibility lies with the Department of Education in London, and it's the individual academy that employs the staff. So the staff are kind of answerable, if you like, to the people to the governing body and the people that sponsor those academies. We're seeing the NHS as well. It's private companies or conglomerates of different associations that are kind of running our schools, as opposed to what was the local authority.
But surely they still have parent governors, just like the old system, don't they?
Yes, they do. They, by law, you've got to have two parent governors on every governing body, whereas the sponsor can have six. And you can have community. Yes.
Well, that's no good, is it? Well, because the parents might say, no, we don't want to do this, but they'd be voted down.
Well, and therein lies the, you know, therein. And the parents have to be quite articulate and quite confident, actually, to be in an environment where you're talking about huge sums of money for secondary schools. We're talking millions of pounds, actually, every year, probably, that is their budget. And it's quite complex. And there's employment law, there's health and safety law, there's education law. So there's areas, you know, it's quite a complex kind of environment.
But you know what bothers me? If I was a parent on a governing body, I'd try to get something done, been voted down once, tried to get something else done, been voted down another time, I'd leave. I wouldn't be bothering to even try and get engaged. Surely, I mean, in any kind of democratic system, you know, after all, this is our money that's funding these schools, the public's money.
Yeah.
Surely the parents should be in the majority.
Well, they're not. I mean, you know, and the governing body, it's the law, it's education law that kind of gets passed down to the people that run the school. But they can have more if they wish. So it's that choice thing again. And generally, and not all the time, but generally the parents that want to become on the governing body they are parents of children at the school, and they come with a particular perspective, generally, you know. And some parent governors are very good and they're very knowledgeable, and others, actually, what they're, you know, that they come maybe with other agendas. But if we had more parent governors, I think that would be, you know, there would be a better balance. But then there are schools that will really struggle to keep their parent governors there, and even parents that don't see themselves necessarily as wanting to be governors or wanting to engage at that level, because the environment in which that governing body's operating just doesn't fit with them.
Well, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? If you think of the number of parents with the children in a particular school, you've probably got all the expertise you need amongst those parents to actually run the place if they were paid to do it. But that's another world, right?
Yes.
Anyway, look, the thing we really come to talk about today is the Merchant Venturer schools in the city. So the Merchant Venturers is an ancient organisation. The Bristol merchants back in 100 years ago discovered America, funded John Cabot's trip over there. Then, of course, that was rather a nasty thing that unfolded in the United States over hundreds of years, which was genocide. Something like 75 million Native Americans slaughtered as America was so-called discovered. But that was the beginning. And then they formed this society of the Merchant Venturers after that. And it still exists to this day. They're quite rich, wealthy. They don't like to share exactly what their wealth is. But there's about 80 or so members. And it seems that they are quite strong in the city, powerful business people, that kind of thing. Many of the big utility companies like Bristol Water, for example, building societies, that kind of thing, have got these Merchant Venturers on their boards. But they're now getting into education in quite a big way. And now they had been, I think, through Colston Boys School and Girls School, running private schools, that kind of thing. But now they're getting into state education. So tell us, whereabouts are the merchants and what are they up to?
Well, they, Judd Laycock, who is the chair of the City Academy across the road, the first academy, is a Merchant Venturer. And he was the chair in 2003. So I knew nothing about the Merchant Venturers before I started hearing, well, you know, Laycock's on the Merchant Venturers. I knew nothing about this organisation at all. So actually, they were, the individuals that would belong to the Merchant Venturers were in getting themselves involved in academies in Bristol right from day one, when Bristol started to academise itself. And actually, 2003 was what they called the first wave of academies. So it was right in at the beginning. And that was fine. That was 2003. In 2008, what we then see are the Merchants Academy open down in the south. And that same year, we see the first two private schools in the country, which was the Cathedral Choir School and Colston Girls School, come out of the private sector and become academies. All of those four schools were run by people that belonged to the Merchant Venturers, and the Merchant Venturers as an organisation became associated to be sponsoring those four secondary schools. Now, if you look on the websites of these schools now, what you'll find is the City Academy has become something called the One World Trust. And the Cathedral Choir School has become this standalone secondary with the primary school. The Colston Girls has also got the Dolphin Primary School in it. And they admit that the Merchant Venturers are their sponsor, and so does the Merchants Academy. But if you looked from the outside today, you wouldn't see those connections between those four secondary schools. But the people involved and the organisation involved are the same as they always have been. And in 2008, they formed something called the Southwest Academies Division. Now, that organisation is still filing counts at Companies House. And there are five shareholders in that organisation. One is the Merchant Venturers, one is the City Academy, one is the Cathedral Choir School, the other Colston Girls School, and the Merchants Academy. So there's still this link, when you look behind the scenes, between those four secondary schools, two of which were private and were never in the local authority. And for me, I think that's a really key. That's really key. These two schools have no history of working together as a system, and neither do the people that run them.
What I think I don't understand about all this is, how can a private school, that is to say, certainly in the old days, all the parents of the pupils would have to be paying fees to go along. How can that become a school which is then suddenly state funded?
Well, that was, I mean, that was the controversy at the time in 2008. I mean, I don't know what hoops those people had to jump through. And it was a Labour local councillor, Derek Pickup Keller, who apparently that was his, you know, when he, because he's just been kicked out of the Labour Party or deselected or whatever they call it. Apparently that was his greatest achievement, was getting these two private schools into the state sector. And he considers that to be a great thing. Now, that they must have, what kind of hoops they must have jumped through in order to get two private schools into the state.
Let's just be clear about Derek. He's still a member of the Labour Party. He hasn't been kicked out of the Labour Party.
No, he's independent.
He was. I think he's decided for himself to leave the Labour Party after he was deselected. But certainly there has been, I think, a discussion within the Labour Party as to whether they wanted Derek to actually be to stand as a city councillor after that. So tell us a little bit about Derek's involvement with that.
I mean, I didn't know at the time. It was only since he's been deselected.
These things often happen, don't they?
You
don't necessarily
find out afterwards.
Realise at the time.
It was a Labour councillor, therefore endorsed by the Labour Party locally, that brought two private schools into the academy sector. And when you watch, you know that film that you talk about that was made in, I think it was made in the mid-90s, it's on YouTube.
This is the film that was made by HTV, James
That's
Garrett, about the Merchant Venturers.
Now on there,
West Eye View it was.
They're talking about, oh look, we're sponsoring the Merchants Academy. There's no mention on there that same year, those two private schools also were two that they opened. So I think that's very interesting. Yeah, so Pickup Callas thinks that this was a great thing that he did for the city. When you actually look into the details of how a private school becomes a state school, what happens is all the children that were in those schools stayed there, and you take the state kids from, you know, into year seven the first year, and then they move up through the school. So actually last year was the year when now have the schools become completely state, if you understand what I mean, because it takes 7 years for it to go all the way through the system, because both of these schools have got sixth forms as well.
So why does it matter?
Why does it matter? Well, for those two schools, the reason that it matters is that from what I've seen, they are basically taken from the same areas that they always did when they were private schools. So the idea that Bristol children are getting all the places at these two schools is not true. Both of these schools will turn away hundreds and hundreds of Bristol kids, but they will allocate places to kids that live in North Somerset, South Gloucestershire. Some of them come from Baines. Some of them come out. There's GL postcodes that they allocate these kids to. And I've got a problem with that, because I know that there are hundreds of Bristol families that want to get their kids in there. And I think that Bristol schools should serve Bristol children. But I also think that because actually some of our council tax locally is spent on education. And I think that is that's quite a key area, really. But what that also does, when you take from huge areas, what it also does is that it means that it's only those in the know, those parents and those families that are kind of in the know, is how you work it so that you can get your kid in there, that actually kind of end up getting in there. So what we also see is this huge discrepancy between the number of kids that are entitled to free school meals going to certain schools and the number of kids across the city and in other secondary schools that are entitled to free school meals. So Cathedral Choir School has got less than 5% free school meals. City Academy's got over 50. Now, those two schools are within walking distance. Cathedral Girls School's got something like 13%. There's no equality in that. There's no equity in that. You know, it's kind of, there are barriers that are in place of families in Bristol that mean they can't get their kids into those schools. And for me, that's a problem.
Interesting, the Merchant Venturers taking this leap from private education into state education and getting us to pay for their schools. Amazing. But then that's not the only thing. I mean, from many years ago, I mean, we're talking about medieval times, when the merchants, Bristol merchants, before the Merchant Venturers were even formed, financed John Cabot's journey to America, discovered so-called America, and that discovery was pretty horrific, led to the genocide of something like 75, they believe now, million Native Americans killed over hundreds of years after we so-called discovered the place. Then, of course, there was a slave trade. Many millions died, something like they believe around 4 or 5 million people died just on the crossing in the triangular trade. All the money was made in Bristol, but of course the slaves never came to Bristol and it was all kept at arm's length. And nowadays, there is also the National Health Service, which is in the process of being privatised. We've got merchant venturers at the helm of the North Bristol Trust and of the United Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust. We've got Peter Rylett as chairman of North Bristol NHS Trust and John Savage, former master of the merchant venturers, in charge of as chairman of the United Hospitals Bristol Trust, altogether spending around about an annual spend of about £1 billion of our money, plus the local enterprise partnership, which is a kind of privatisation of much of local government through the things like the Bristol Public Property Board, chaired also by a merchant venturer and James Jury, I think the guy's name is. So these people are quite strong behind the scenes, aren't they? And what about sport? I think they're quite big in sport too, Christine.
Well, yeah, because John Laycock, well, he made his money out of Brandon Tallhire, but at one time he also owned Bristol City. And in 2003, when the City Academy kind of reopened as an academy, the Bristol City was kind of really closely associated, and they had their sporting academy on site. And sport is the is seen as the kind of specialism at the City Academy, so he's really heavily involved in that. But merchant venturers are also involved in Gloucester, they're also heavily involved in the cricket clubs in Bristol, and they're also interested in the rugby clubs and Bath University. We've seen, you know, that's kind of had lots of money from the big lottery, and you know, these people are they are behind the scenes, as you say, in control of huge amounts of public and private money. But what's also I find quite disturbing is that they have this thing called the Royal Charter, don't they? And that came into existence before what we would consider to be democracy. Well, well we was, might it, not consider it to be democracy.
It was before the Civil War.
It was before the Civil War.
And even though, actually, a lot of people would argue that there wasn't really a lot of democracy after the Civil War, just maybe a tiny fraction less monarchy. Yeah. But anyway, so also the that, I mean, the point of being about the Charter is the lack of financial transparency, so they don't have to file accounts at Companies House, so people can't find out how much they're worth, for example. Simple stuff like that. What about also the Quartet Foundation? Because this is the great jewel in the crown, we're told, the wonderful part of the merchant venturers, which is giving back to Bristol far more than they could ever take.
And the thing about the Quartet Foundation is that, I mean, if anyone's involved in kind of, you know, voluntary or community sector organisations in Bristol, they would have heard of this because, you know, year on year, there's money that you can apply for, but we're talking tiny, tiny bits of money. And the merchant venturers, it's pushed, their PR pushes this to say, this is, you know, this is what we do in the city, and we invest in, you know, people, you know, the older people and people that may not be in a position to, you know, that maybe they need some support. And, you know, we invest in areas around inequality. But actually, I want to know where they get their money from, because if they're running our schools, I want to know that the ethics around what they're investing in actually fits with the values that they portray to have.
OK, so do I. And I think we're going to have to resume this conversation at some time. Christine, how can people follow your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter. If you just put in Twitter and my name, it will come up.
At Christine Townsend.
It's something like at IFB Christine, something like that. But if you put in Twitter Christine Townsend, you will see it. That's going to be the main bit, really, where this comes out. But there's a few other things that I'm investigating at the moment as well. So following on from a few things that happened in our cathedral last November to do with the church, the merchant venturers and some of our state schools. So that's kind of still in the pipeline. But these things take time, don't they? And there's also a cut behind the scenes. Also, there's a couple of investigations around unlawful practice that are still being looked at and have yet to be reported on.
Great. Well, stay on the case, Christine. We'll have you back as soon as possible. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Jeff, what's on guide?
Thank you, Tony. This is What's on Guide from Dialect. starting with Friday, January 16th, Mr. T and the Minions will be performing with support from the Convicts at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Into Saturday, January 17th, Guns N' Roses, who are the original, the best and the only Guns N' Roses tribute to feature the closest slash lookalike, will be performing with support from the Dirty Smooth at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Into Song of the Week, and I present Guns N' Roses. This group formed in 1985 and are still performing and recording to this day, though with only one original member of the band. In their career, they have released 6 studio albums, 1 live album and 19 singles. This is from the album Appetite for Destruction, which was released in 1987, and is the song Anything Goes. That was Guns N' Roses with Anything Goes from the album Appetite for Destruction. For more information on Guns N' Roses, check out www.guns2roses, that is Guns N' Roses with the number 2, .simplesite.com. That's www.guns2roses.simplesite.com. And also go see Guns N' Roses at the Underworld in Camden, London on Friday, March the 6th when they have Bumblefoot of Guns N' Roses in their lineup. Also on Saturday 17th of January, Control will be performing with support from Boots and All at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Happy New Year, Jeff. that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download this podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Bye for now. Yeah.